Imagine standing on a Long Island airfield on a September morning in 1922. The grass is still damp. The crowd has been gathering since before the planes are even fueled. Tens of thousands of people, most of them Black Americans who have come by train, by car, some who walked miles through the early fall heat, they press up against the ropes, they shade their eyes and look at the sky. A biplane lifts off the runway at Curtis Field. It climbs, banks hard, and pulls into a series of loops and figure eights that bring the crowd roaring to their feet. The pilot is a 29-year-old woman who grew up picking cotton in Texas. Her name is Bessie Coleman. She holds the only international aviation license issued to a Black woman in the history of the world. Pull up a chair. I'm Taildragger, and this is the Hangar on Radio Hangar. The story of how Bessie Coleman got to that airfield is one of the most determined journeys in the history of this business. And I would argue it says as much about what one person can decide to be as any famous flight or famous aircraft you have ever heard of. She was born in Atlanta, Texas, in 1892. The ninth of 13 children. Her family were sharecroppers, and Bessie spent her early years picking cotton in the fields outside of Waxahachie, south of Dallas. She was whip-smart and deeply ambitious. She was also growing up in a part of America that had very specific ideas about what a poor Black girl from a sharecropping family was allowed to want. She taught herself to read beyond what the schoolhouse offered. She did math in her head better than most of the adults around her. She walked 4 miles each way to the one-room schoolhouse that served her community. She finished at the top of her class. At 18, she enrolled at Langston University in Oklahoma, then called the Colored Agricultural and Normal University. She ran out of money after one semester and had to come home. Around 1916, she moved north to Chicago. Her brothers were already there. She worked as a manicurist on the South Side, on the Stroll State Street, where the Black community was building something remarkable during the first wave of the Great Migration. She saved carefully. She read the papers. She watched the world moving. Chicago in those years was electric with news of what airplanes were doing. The First World War had just ended. Returning veterans had stories, and the Barnstormers were already out there selling $5 rides and performing stunts that looked physically impossible. Bessie heard from her brothers about women in France who were already flying commercially. Something clicked. A direction she had not seen before, she walked into every flight school in Chicago and asked to enroll. She was turned away from every single one. Some said it was because she was a woman. Some said it was because she was Black. Several did not bother explaining. This was the early 1920s and the door was simply closed. She did not grieve long. She pivoted. Today's show is brought to you by AviationSoul.com, aviation challenge coins for every milestone in flight. First solo, private pilot, instrument rating all the way up. If you've earned it, they've got a coin for it. Every coin tells a story. Check them out at AviationSoul.com. The man who changed everything was Robert Abbott. Abbott was the founder and publisher of the Chicago Defender, which by 1920 was one of the most influential newspapers in America, Black or otherwise. The Defender ran tens of thousands of copies and was read nationwide, folded inside other papers to pass through train stations in the South without drawing attention. Abbott was a visionary, and when Bessie Coleman walked into his office and told him what she was trying to do, he recognized another one. His advice was direct. If America will not teach you to fly, go somewhere that will. Go to France. He and a Chicago real estate developer named Jesse Binga helped finance the trip. But Bessie had work to do first. France meant French. She spent months taking language lessons in the evenings while continuing to work as a manicurist during the day. She applied to flight schools affiliated with the Fédération Aéronautique Internationale, the international body that set the standard for pilot certification, the FAI. She was accepted at the Caudron Brothers School of Aviation. In November of 1920, she boarded a ship for Europe. She was 27 years old, and she had never left the country. The Caudron School was at Le Crotoy on the Channel coast of northern France near the Somme estuary. Cold and flat and windy, the aircraft were Nieuport biplanes, fabric over wood and wire, essentially the same machines that had fought over the trenches not 5 years before. The instructors were former military pilots. They were not running a finishing school. The language barrier was real, and it was daily. She pushed through it. One of her classmates was killed in a crash during her training, right in front of her. The Nieuport was not a gentle airplane. She got back in the cockpit the next day. She soloed. She flew cross countries over a landscape still scarred by the war. She passed her examinations. On June 15, 1921, Bessie Coleman received pilot certificate number 2088 from the FAI. She was the first African American to hold an internationally recognized pilot's license. She was the first woman of Native American heritage to hold one as well. Her mother's family carried Cherokee blood, and Bessie always claimed that heritage as her own. She was the first black woman on Earth to hold a pilot's license. Full stop. She did not come home right away. She spent more months in Europe, training with experienced pilots in France and Germany. She flew demonstration flights. She watched the European air show circuit with a professional eye. She wanted to understand stunt flying from the pilots who had invented it. She wanted to be very, very good before she came home. When she arrived in New York in the fall of 1921, the Defender put her on the front page. She wore her uniform. She was precise and direct in every interview, and she said the same thing each time. She intended to build a flight school for black Americans. The air shows were the means. The school was the end. On September 3, 1922, she performed the first public air show by a black aviator in American history at Curtis Field on Long Island. The crowd was enormous. She flew loops and wingovers and low passes that had people stepping back from the ropes. She cut the engine on one pass and let the biplane whisper overhead in near silence so the crowd could feel the wind off the wings. She knew exactly what she was doing. Not good for a woman, good, just good, flat out good. The Defender ran it across the front page. Wire services picked it up nationwide. Bessie Coleman was a public figure overnight. They called her Queen Bess. They called her Brave Bessie. She barnstormed through the 1920s across the Midwest, the South, and the East Coast, performing at county fairs and civic celebrations and air shows organized specifically for black audiences. Word spread through the black press, which meant word spread everywhere that mattered. When Bessie Coleman came to town, the community knew and they showed up by the thousands. She had a rule, non-negotiable. If the organizers required a segregated entrance, separate gates, and separate sections for black and white attendees, she refused to fly. She walked, she returned deposits. She did not negotiate on it, for a woman trying to finance a flight school out of barnstorming proceeds in the Jim Crow era. That rule cost her real money. She held the line every time. She told a Georgia reporter plainly that aviation, in her experience, did not see color the way the ground did. Up there, she said, you were just a pilot. She intended to live as close to that principle as the world would allow. In 1923, she bought a surplus Curtis Jenny in California and flew herself into the Pacific Coast Circuit. The Jenny was a tired airplane. On a landing approach near Santa Monica, the engine quit. The aircraft nosed over on touchdown, and Bessie was thrown from the cockpit. She broke ribs. She broke her leg. She was lying in a field looking up at the California sky while people ran toward her. She spent months recovering. She wrote letters from her bed. She gave interviews. She was not done. When she could walk again, she went back to flying. She booked more shows. She kept up the lecture circuit through black churches and schools across the South, often speaking for little or nothing because the message mattered more than the fee. She wanted young people to see her. She wanted them to understand that the sky was not closed to them just because so many doors on the ground were. She had identified a building in Houston for the school. She had curriculum ideas written out. It was still the plan. The end came on April 30, 1926. She was in Jacksonville, Florida. A parachute exhibition was scheduled for the following day. The airplane was a Curtis Jenny, flown by her publicity manager, a man named William Wills. Bessie was in the front cockpit, leaning out over the side to scout the field below for her parachute jump. She had unstrapped her seatbelt to do it. At about 1,000 feet, the Jenny entered a dive it did not pull out of. The aircraft rolled inverted. Bessie Coleman fell from the cockpit. She fell the full 1,000 feet to the ground. Wills died minutes later when the Jenny struck the earth. Investigators found a wrench inside the control linkage. Whether it arrived there by accident or by something more deliberate has never been conclusively settled. She was 33 years old. She had held her license for less than 5 years. 10,000 people came to her funeral in Chicago. They lined the streets. Ida B. Wells, the journalist and civil rights activist, helped organize the ceremony. The tributes filled the papers, and then, as happens with pioneers who die young, her name faded from the broader conversation for a generation. The people who knew what she had done did not forget.
In 1977, a group of black women aviators flew formation from across the country to Chicago and dropped flowers over her grave from the air. A deliberate echo of the morning flights from half a century before. A statement that the line held and the work was still going. She has a United States postage stamp issued in 1995. She has airports and schools named for her. The Bessie Coleman Aeronautics Camp has been putting young aviators in the air in her name for decades. The Smithsonian holds her in their permanent collection. Her FAI certificate, signed and dated June 15, 1921, is one of the most remarkable documents in the history of this country, but the stamp and the schools are not the story. The story is a woman who was told no so thoroughly that her own country gave her nothing to work with, who learned a foreign language, who crossed an ocean alone, who trained in the cold and wind of a French coastal airfield on airplanes that were killing the people around her, who came home and spent the rest of her shortened life holding a line of principle at real personal cost, every time without exception. Every aviator who has ever been told they do not belong in the sky owes at least a thought to Bessie Coleman, because she did it first, without a handbook, without anyone ahead of her to ask. Back when aviation was fabric and wire, and open cockpits, and nobody was sure if any of this was going to hold together, she got in the airplane. And she flew. My thanks to Doris Rich's biography Queen Bess and to the Smithsonian National Air and Space Museum for keeping the record straight. Find us at radiohangar.com. I'm Taildragger. Keep the blue side up.